It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast brought to you by Fox News. You can check out all the Fox News podcasts at foxnewspodcast.com. I hope that you'll rate, review, and subscribe to this one. Today, I have a conversation with Michael Knowles. He is the author of the new book, Speechless, Controlling Words, Controlling Minds. Michael's probably familiar to you for a stunt that he did, a satirical bestseller called Reasons to Vote for Democrats that was entirely blank in terms of the pages inside. It was a good gag gift, and obviously a lot of people bought it for people who they wanted to affect when it came to this kind of a thing. This edition of Speechless, on the other hand, is full of words, chock full of them, and it is focused on words, the power that they have over our dialogue, over the way that they affect our perspectives on politics, and over innumerable aspects of the current debates that we find ourselves in as it relates to race, gender, and the like. I hope you will enjoy my conversation with Michael Knowles.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day, featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
Michael Knowles, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Ben, it is great to be with you.
I want to talk to you about your first book that actually has words inside of it today, Speechless, which is an interesting take on something that I think a lot of people have recognized that is going on in the country and in these debates intellectually with the left that we see happen. But they may not have known the history or the information that you have in this book about the power of controlling language and the way that it is used by the left. Why was this the topic that you decided to put pen to paper on for the first time?
Well, in part, the answer is I just thought it would be kind of funny, having written my first book without any words, to then write my second book entirely about words. I just got a bit of a kick out of that. But people actually, I think, are misinterpreting the title a little bit, especially on the left. I've had people say to me, as though this is some kind of dunk, that, you know, it's ridiculous for me to have a book called Speechless, Controlling Words, Controlling Minds, when I have a relatively large platform and I'm reaching a number of people with it and a lot of people are buying it, as though I'm simply complaining about some overt censorship. The title is more descriptive than anything. I'm simply pointing out that through our language, we color how we see the world, and our perception is greatly shaped, and our politics is shaped. And so the left is very good at manipulating language, but I'm not even knocking them for that. I think speech makes us the political animal. That's speech is politics in a republic such as ours. And so I'm really encouraging conservatives to get better at understanding language, not to manipulate it in such a way that we attempt to invert reality, as the left is doing in so many ways, but rather to get a handle on our language so that we can be more persuasive and so that we can better craft the standards that form the limits of our society. In many ways, this book is harder on the right than it is on the left, mm-hmm. because the radical leftists who gave us political correctness, which we now call wokeness or cancel culture, in many ways, I think they understood free speech and censorship much better than the conservatives have. And I think that we should learn from them and attempt to finally push back against this cultural takeover.
I was talking with someone recently who quoted something from, I believe, Scott Adams to me, where he was saying that it was a mistake on the part of the left to give the brand of critical race theory to CRT, that it actually gave a descriptor that people on the right could then go after. And he was saying this from a fairly politically centrist position, though he is definitely anti-woke. I thought that was an interesting perspective on the way that branding works, that sometimes it can be a very powerful thing, as we saw used to great effect by Donald Trump through his rise in politics. On the other side, it also can give you something to target and to attack. And it seems to me that in this current discussion, the left is very frustrated by seeing a couple of situations where this has kind of backfired on them, you know, with defund the police, for instance, being another example of it. Tell me a little bit about that kind of power of branding, how it works within the political sphere, how conservatives can do it better, and what we can learn from some of these recent experiences with the left.
Well, the new popularity of this phrase, critical race theory, is a big problem for the left. And I think we actually have Chris Rufo over at City Journal to thank in large part for this phrase becoming the lightning rod. And this is the thing that everybody is talking about. But in the left's defense, I want to defend their tactics a little bit here. They picked about the best title I think they possibly could have, because critical race theory derives from the broader tradition of critical theory. And critical theory is really a genius political movement, because once you get past all of the pretentious jargon, the theory is just to criticize. And so, I suppose we have to give names to all sorts of academic movements, and that's just the way it goes. But if you're going to have a name, having it be criticism itself is a pretty good one, because you can criticize anything. I think this goes back to a line that Karl Marx said to Arnold Ruge, which is that he called for the ruthless criticism of all that exists. Martin Jay, who is a sympathetic historian of the Frankfurt School and critical theory broadly, points out that critical theory, as understood by the critical theorists, is not so much an academic system in itself, but a gadfly on other academic systems, which is why there's no critical theory department at the university. A critical theory has just permeated all these other sorts of departments, literature, history, probably mathematics before we're done, before the scene is finished. So the genius of just criticizing the other theories is that everything in this fallen world is susceptible to criticism. It's why all the statues are falling down now. It's why we're erasing so much of our natural history. And what Chris Rufo and now the right more broadly is doing is they're grabbing on to critical theory and saying, this is it. This is the problem. Hold on to this and ban it from the schools. And so you're seeing the left retreat to nominalism, and they're shrugging their shoulders and they're saying, well, what really is critical race theory? Actually, it's, well, we know what it is. We've got a lot of writings on this topic. I've actually tried to outline in my book the history of how we got here. But it will not be enough just to criticize something like critical race theory. I suspect what we're going to have to do is offer a substantive vision ourselves. I think so much of this politically correct program is just a negative campaign to tear down the traditional standards of our society. And what we have done on the right is basically throw up our hands and defend things like free speech in the abstract, but not really any substantive vision in practice. And I just fear that free speech only has meaning to people who have something to say. And so the right needs to actually offer that substantive vision.
So speaking of free speech, I do think that one of my favorite Onion headlines of all time, which I think today would have to be at the Babylon Bee, is "Gay Pride Parade Sets Mainstream Acceptance of Gays Back 50 Years," which ran about two decades ago. And you write about the branding of Pride Month a little bit during this, and we are speaking during Pride Month. And you contrast it with the idea of like a gay acceptance month or something like that as being the alternative. Tell me a little bit about the power that comes from just, picking the right words to brand a movement that ultimately, I think no one can argue, that in terms of the difference in laws that we have today versus 20 years ago, there's nothing that compares to really the advances that that gay Americans have achieved, I think, in so many different respects. What is the power that comes from just picking the right branding for your movement?
Well, the entire gay marriage debate was basically a semantic trick. I don't even like to call it a debate because there never was any debate. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the romantic poet Anthony Kennedy, who was a justice on the Supreme Court, he waxed philosophic about the constitutional right to intimacy. Not sure where in the emanations and the penumbras that one is, but he just redefined marriage from what it had always been to now a union where sexual difference doesn't matter. But if there were to be a debate over same-sex marriage, the debate would have had to begin with the question, what is marriage? For all of human history, everywhere in the world, people have always believed that sexual difference has something to do with marriage. even in societies that permitted polygamy, still sexual difference was the essential feature there. And then about 5 minutes ago, people decided that sexual difference has nothing to do with marriage. And so we could have had that debate. Unfortunately, though, I think the radicals and the redefiners would have lost that debate because they haven't a leg to stand on. So instead, what they did, and they did this through powerful organizations such as the preposterously named Human Rights Campaign, the group that had the little equal sign bumper sticker to promote the redefinition of marriage. What they did was they presumed their own conclusion. They begged the question and they said, look, we already know that marriage has nothing to do with sexual difference. So we just believe that gay people need to have the right to get married. Well, that's not what we're talking about at all. Before we can discuss the right, we need to know what marriage is. But they begged the question. And then when the debate, such as it was, became about rights, obviously the radicals had already won it because no reasonable, charitable person wants to deny anyone a right. So they just assumed their own right and then they won the so-called debate. The one branding issue they've had, as you point out, is Pride Month. I mean, it is a little strange to make your movement named after the queen of all vices, you know, the deadliest of the seven deadly sins. Frankly, even Gay Wrath or Gay Gluttony Month would have.
So I was going to say Gay Wrath Month would be, I assume this mostly, you know, just knowing so many friends of mine who are gay, would mostly consist of judging clothing in a very harsh way, biting and hilariously for the entire month. And I actually could get down with that.
Yeah, like, that'd
be very wonderful. But the thing that phases out of this, because you talk about the differences in the sexes, is you, and you have an entire chapter about this, is this battle that I think all of us saw coming that would come out of not having a debate about this, by the way. I mean, and just to your point, I agree entirely. As someone who is actually a supporter of gay marriage, my biggest argument all along was we're doing this the wrong way. That this needed to be a debate that happened within society, that you could have this move through states, and that I think progressively you would have seen states pairing certain things. In other words, pairing religious protections, for instance, with changes in marriage. That this needed to be something that the people decide, as opposed to being bequeathed from the mountaintop by Anthony Kennedy. But anyway, moving on to this issue about the sexes. Everyone, you know, particularly, you know, Ryan Anderson and people like that warning of slippery slopes turned out to be completely correct, that we moved rapidly beyond a redefinition of marriage as a union to the definition of people and gender and sex in a way that I think, you know, it has to make everybody's head spin. And clearly, you know, has made a lot of people's head spin who considered themselves to be politically on the left or liberal. I mean, how many people are we at now in terms of sort of ACLU era liberals from 1995 who have been canceled or mugged by reality when it came to the things that they have written about transitioning and that kind of thing? You know, obviously Katie Herzog and Jesse Singel have a podcast together, Blocked and Reported, they're both liberals. They are both, you know, left of center. They both, you know, were, you know, Biden supporters and the like. They both also got essentially canceled for writing very popularly read articles about people who either questioned, you know, injecting hormones in kids or just generally were not down with the transgender movement. Tell me a little bit about the meaning of language as it relates to that, because that seems to be such a hot button element of this, even to the point that government is now wrestling with whether, you know, using the correct pronouns is something that can be counted under the general rubric of harassment. And the like.
Of course, it drives me crazy when people on the left, or sometimes sort of more apathetic people on the right, will say, oh, who cares about the pronouns? My answer is the left cares about the pronouns. That's why they're investing a lot of time and energy and money into redefining all of the pronouns. And sometimes you hear people say, as you note, the liberals mugged by reality. They'll say, this has gone too far. Actually, the transgender movement is now contradicting the gay rights movement, because gay rights says we're born this way and you need to tolerate us. And transgender says, doesn't matter how you're born. Not only can you change your preferences, you can actually change your sex itself. Mm-hmm. And or some people are saying, well, transgenderism contradicts feminism because, you know, transgenderism denies that woman is even its own category. Or an immutable category. And I think there actually is a kind of perverse coherence from the radical movements that we've seen even 50, 60 years ago on the left, all the way up to transing the kids. Namely, if the second wave feminists are right, that there is really no substantive difference between men and women, and the superficial differences can be remedied through things like, I don't know, birth control and new laws. You know, a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle. Well, then men and women really are the same. And then the same-sex marriage question becomes very simple. You've already solved that, because if men and women, practically speaking, really are just the same and interchangeable, then a man and a woman and a man and a man and a woman and a woman are all basically the same thing. And if a man and a woman really are interchangeable, then Bruce Jenner can become Caitlyn, and there's no big deal about that. And what's really beginning to scare people here is the kids aspect of all of it. The idea that it's not just a 30-year-old man who is sexually confused who can transform his body to look more like a woman, but it's a 7-year-old kid. Yeah. And some people have brought up this issue of consent. Well, you know, gosh, we have age of consent laws. If a 17-year-old girl sleeps with her 19-year-old boyfriend, it could be a major crime. It could involve jail time. But if a 7-year-old girl wants to mutilate her body and her genitals irretrievably or irreparably in some cases, then that's perfectly fine. How does the 7-year-old have the ability to consent to a much more significant thing than the 17-year-old? Well, because it's not really a question of consent. It's a question of nature. We are establishing the Gnostic heresy, actually. We're establishing this claim that who we truly are has nothing to do with our bodies. And we're establishing that as a fact of nature. And so if it's true for a 30-year-old, it's true for a 3-year-old as well. And I think that it's going to be very difficult to argue against transing the kids if you accept that basic premise that a man really can become a woman at some point.
You criticize David French in your portion on his writings about the drag queen story hour as being one of the blessings of liberty. As you may know, our daughter is named Liberty, and so we call her diapers blessings of liberty. I'm absolutely serious about that.
That is terrific.
But the thing that look, it's another blessing. The thing that I think is so short-sighted about this, and I don't think French is a stupid person, but I think he is rather naive about the direction that this would take, is that I think he has a bit of a lawyer's bias, which is to sort of view this as entirely something that can be contested against on the polite field of battle that takes place within the courtroom. And from my perspective, what actually is this is all of a piece, meaning that court battles are one thing, but they are primarily a defensive action. You know, is it good that Hobby Lobby was able to defend themselves in court? Of course. You know, is the argument that the Little Sisters of the Poor makes important? Of course it is. But the cultural battle, to me, is where this whole debate is actually won or lost, and that takes primacy over the courtroom. Because, you know, even it really mattered, for instance, that Anthony Kennedy felt comfortable doing what he did because of the way that the cultural winds were blowing, much more than from my perspective, that he did what he did. And so in this case, I view some of these things as being so toxic and dangerous for America's youth that they have to be fought against with every, you know, on every level, on every space that they can have. I mean, 60 Minutes, when they did this recent profile that got them completely trashed by the, you know, uh, the ACLU and the Human Rights Campaign and all the other usual suspects about detransitioners. I mean, one of the people that they profiled in that was a teenage girl who transitioned, had top surgery, and detransitioned all in the space of a calendar year. I mean, that's horrifying. That's just, I mean, it's child abuse. Yeah. And it's not something that we should allow to continue any more than we would allow that, you know, then we should, you know, accept the idea that being addicted to fentanyl is totally fine or something like that. Yeah,
right.
You know,
and
I mean, it's just not, it's not something that we should treat as being a social good. We should treat it as a social ill. What can be done and how can we change this argument around to convince sort of the French adjacent people in the world, because I don't think you're going to convince him, but yeah, let's just say the people who have been reading him for years and like him and want to sort of see this through that lens, that that's not the right lens to view it through.
Yes, I actually hesitated at naming David specifically, because I don't want to make it about him, but he did make this insane claim that Drag Queen Story Hour is a blessing of liberty. I think that sound you're hearing right now is James Madison rolling around in his grave. and so I did have to address the topic, because I think your point on the lawyer's bias might have something to do with it. And I think this is it. Essentially the misunderstanding that we have right now, not just on the nature of the free speech regime, but on the nature of liberty itself. The founding fathers did not give us this country for Drag Queen Story Hour. They would have run the Drag Queen Story Hour people out of town on a rail. It would have been unthinkable to them. But I guess I want to be somewhat charitable to David's argument. I think what he's saying is, if we prevent perverts from twerking for toddlers at the public library or in the elementary school, why then they might prevent us from going to church on Sunday? And first of all, just as a practical matter, they are already preventing us from going to church on Sunday. They spent much of last year preventing us from doing that.
Yes, absolutely.
So the hypothetical, I think, is quite real. But even beyond that, if we are going to accept this radical kind of skepticism, then I think we basically need to surrender self-government, because our republic is premised on the idea that we can discern right from wrong, true from false, good from bad, at least to some degree, that our faculties of reason and our moral conscience is somewhat reliable. And so if we can't tell the difference between these perverts twerking for toddlers and going to church, that's fine if we're just willing to surrender our faculties of reason and our moral conscience. But then I think we need to surrender self-government, because all laws, contrary to popular slogans, legislate morality. All lawmaking has some reference to the moral order. And when we get together in a society, that's the sort of thing that we do. I think that a big difference here, a big cause of this misunderstanding, is the conflation in recent years of liberty and license. The founding fathers were very clear that liberty must not be abused to licentiousness. And I think we've come to believe that liberty is just the ability to do whatever you want. And it's not, you know, in the words of Lord Acton, liberty is not the ability to do whatever you want whenever you please. It's the right to do what you ought to do. And the clear example is on this fentanyl point, actually, or heroin, say. You know, according to the modern liberal definition of liberty, the heroin addict is the freest man who ever lived, especially if the laws don't prevent him from shooting up. As long as he's got a couple bucks in his pocket and he can score some dope, oh boy, isn't he so free? No, I don't think he's free in reality. You and I know that he's a slave. He's totally enslaved to his passions, because true liberty is not just pursuing your basest desires, but it's taming those desires down and bringing them into accord with your higher will. You have a lower will, which is your appetite, and you have a higher will, which is rational. This is why St. Paul writes, the things I want to do, I do not do, and the things I don't want to do, I do. To some people, that might sound like it doesn't make sense, but you and I all know that. You know, you go out to the bar and you think, I shouldn't have that extra drink. But then maybe you do have that extra drink, or you're at the buffet and you say, I really shouldn't have a second plate, but then you do. Well, why? Because your lower will is in conflict with your rational will. And so the process of liberal education, right, literally making sense of your liberty, has always been that we discipline our lowest passions, we bring them into order underneath our rational will, and we cultivate the habits of virtue that make for true liberty. This is why when John Adams says that our nation is built for a moral and religious people, he's not just being some Bible-thumping scold. He really wasn't much of a Bible-thumper. He's just making a descriptive statement about politics. You know, self-government really will only work for a people that has cultivated and practices virtue and religion. And to deny that in favor of this sort of cult of licentiousness is not just ridiculous, but it's very short-sighted because it's going to crumble your entire project of self-government.
Yes, I mean, so much of this comes back to the ramen guy and, you know, informing Chris Cuomo that, yes, this is where it says that protest is supposed to be peaceful. Yeah. You know, it's not riotous and not violent. So you write, you have a chapter about big tech, which I think, you know, anybody with a book of this title, you know, needs to wrestle with, since it is the place where so many people have their right to speech infringed upon and it leads to them being suspended or banned or you know, restricted in different ways, sometimes that they can see and sometimes that they can't. Tell me a little bit about your own perspective on this issue. And again, I think that what the lawyer's bias plays here again too, because I have yet to be convinced that there is a legal answer to a lot of the things that we would like to see changed about these platforms. I do believe that things like Section 230 represent essentially corporate welfare, that they are a special protection, and that those types of special protections ought to be reexamined in light of the way that these platforms are behaving. And that, you know, oftentimes, I mean, regulations and antitrust sort of approaches are updated all the time. And the fact that they haven't been within the world of Silicon Valley in large part is one of the reasons that they can get away with so many things that they do, but it's also not necessarily going to fix the problem to just sort of tear it apart and go back to zero. What is your own perspective on the way that people who believe in free speech, you know, conservatives and liberals alike, I would say, can unite in order to try to find a path forward on this, something that has become so central to American life that, you know, I get emails from people every day saying, I tried to share this and now I'm banned, or I'm deplatformed, or I'm shadow banned, et cetera, et cetera. What could be done about that, and what ought the right ought to do when it comes to that issue?
Or specifically, they might say, I'm trying to share this breaking report about a major Biden scandal weeks before the election, and I'm not even allowed to privately message it. Right. Obviously, that was a big deal. And then big tech crossed the Rubicon when they deplatformed the duly elected sitting president of the United States on January 7th and January 8th. No matter what you think happened in the election, the man was the duly elected sitting president at the time, and he was kicked out of the public square because a handful of oligarchs in Silicon Valley, hipster Rasputin, Mr. Dorsey among them, just decided that they could censor him, and he really has been quite effectively censored. They decided they were going to enforce a standard. They said that we're not going to permit this kind of speech on our platform, and there are always going to be limits to polite discourse, and we're now going to limit what the president says, and so they booted him off. And they claim that that's their right, and if you don't like it, build your own Google. Sounds a little preposterous to me, but sure. Section 230 plays an important role here, not only because it is, as you say, corporate welfare, and not only because these big tech companies have established their critical mass in many ways through fraud, and not only because of other legal challenges, but because Section 230 comes from the Communications Decency Act. Communications Decency Act was one of two major laws passed during the Clinton administration with a Democrat Senate but a Republican House that sought to limit pornography on the internet. This was a law about protecting free speech by limiting some of what people might call speech. And I think this is what's really confusing for people these days. People have been confused, again, on this conflation of liberty and licentiousness, to believe that pornography is somehow an expression of free speech. That view would have been alien to our founding fathers and the framers of our Constitution and basically everybody in the country until about 5 minutes ago, including both the Republicans and the Democrats as late as the late 1990s. as recently as a dozen years ago, we threw a pornographer in prison, in federal prison, for almost 4 years, just for obscenity. Not he didn't have child pornography. He didn't rape anybody on his sets. He just put out content that was so obscene that he went to the clink for almost 4 years. And now people think this is somehow a violation of free speech. But from the beginning of our country, there are whole swaths of speech that have been off limits. Obscenity, fraud, obviously, direct threats, and a number of others. And the reason, or one of the reasons for them to be off limits, is that kind of speech actually undermines speech. If we have a legal protection for fraud, then you're actually undermining speech because no one can rely on the truth of what anybody is saying. If you have a legal protection for obscenity, it undermines speech because it undermines people's liberty and it actually arouses their base passions and their lower will, right? And you'll be saturated in prurient and obscene content, which actually I think just describes the way society is at the moment. So that's a big problem too. I think it would be foolish for conservatives to make the argument from the position of what you might call the free speech absolutist view, you know, that Facebook and Twitter and Google have no right to in any way uphold a standard on their platforms. Of course, standards are inevitable. I mean, every society, every human endeavor has some sort of taboos, has some sort of standards. Some things are off limits. Some things will get you ostracized. So I just think you're warring with reality if you're trying to argue from that perspective. I think we just need to establish a standard, or rather we need to look back to the free speech tradition in America and embrace standards that have guided us very well, use our faculties of prudence. I know prudence is a virtue we're not allowed to talk about anymore in our very ideological age, but I think that would be very helpful as well. And so when we're talking about the specific issue of reducing the control of big tech, I think we need to get over our sloganeering about the dangers of big government. I still hate big government. I hate unlimited government. But as Mitch McConnell pointed out the other day, I don't want woke corporations to act as a parallel government that's actually even less accountable to the people than the regular old government is. And getting back to good old trust-busting Teddy Roosevelt, I would prefer to, and Barry Goldwater for that matter, I want a war against any institution that has apparently unlimited power, because if Google takes away my free speech rights, that doesn't make me feel any better than if the government does. Mm-hmm. In some ways, it makes me feel actually a little bit worse. I think we need to go back into the tradition of speech and of dealing with these corporations in an American context, and then update our laws, as you say, and bring them back into accord in a way that we all want to live by.
I feel like one of the things that you're touching on there is this, again, kind of this bias toward thinking that the only danger that really exists to our speech rights and the like comes from people who are elected. And that to me is very short-sighted, because the unelected often wield more power in America than the elected. You know, the massive bureaucracy that has been created over the past century, you know, beginning with Woodrow Wilson and continuing to grow and to encompass more and more of American life. And then, you know, I think people saw during this pandemic that there were people who exercised power over the way that they lived that they perhaps never really realized beforehand, that it mattered more who the local school board was, or the local sheriff, or their state health department heads were, then it actually mattered, you know, who their congressional representative was, and that to me is something that I hope will lead to a form of enlightenment for those on the right, that's going to be something that they have to change and pay more attention to. Do you believe that that's something that is happening or will happen? Or is that kind of is this whole pandemic and looking back through it, is the left going to be able to turn it into the permanent state of the way that we are governed?
Well, I don't think it'll be quite so easy as the parents going and yelling at their school boards. I mean, that gives me a hope. But as you mentioned, this awful political system that we are increasingly living under goes back a long way. It goes back all the way to Woodrow Wilson. A great many evils can be traced back to Woodrow Wilson. And Wilson points out in his essay, What is Progress? He says, look, we used to live under the laws of Newton, and in the laws of Newton, fixed laws of the universe, it made sense to have a separation of powers and, you know, checks and balances in our government. But now we know that's all bunk, and Darwin taught us that actually everything's always evolving and changing, and everything's kind of an organism, man, you know. And so therefore, we need to empower not just the government, but specifically bureaucrats and technocrats within the government who are completely unaccountable to the American people. We need to empower them to go out and run our lives for us. Ironically, since that time, it seems as though everything has become more and more political. Our running shoes are political now. Our sports are all sorts of political, except for politics. Politics has been taken out of the political sphere, and it's been given to the Dr. Faucis of the world. Dr. Fauci, the high pontiff of progressivism, who wears a lab coat instead of a cassock and a stethoscope instead of a pectoral cross. But he has the same sort of power as the Pope. You know, he's frankly got more power than the Pope in this country because Joe Biden actually listens to him. So Dr. Fauci can change his views at any given time. And we were told we have to listen to him, and we have to listen to the science. I think even beyond Fauci and just the public health establishment, I think what people are beginning to realize is that this distinction between the government and private enterprise, or the public and the private, is a little bit blurrier than we had thought it was. Is Google public or private? Is it the government, or is it just a private company? Well, it ain't a mom and pop, I'll tell you that. And it works with the government, but I guess it's distinct from the government. And what about the universities? The universities are kind of the government, but they're sort of private. What about the media? I mean, especially the news media are just a propaganda arm for the liberal establishment. So to me, when I'm looking at all of these institutions, I think it's all just kind of the blob. You know, I think the blob is all sort of working in tandem, and it has been acting that way for quite some time, and it was by design, going back at least to Wilson. And I think we have fallen for this trap whereby conservatives, cut off our abilities to fight back against these things because of bumper sticker slogans to private enterprise, and because we've been shilling for multinational corporations that hate us and hate our way of life and want to totally upend our traditions. So yes, we need to recognize where power really lies. I mean, Wilson might not have been right in his prescription, but he was right in his description. The way the government works in this country right now is quite different than how you would have been taught in civics class if we actually still had civics class. And so we need to fight the power where the power really is. And that involves getting rid of some of our silly canards and slogans we've had for 20 or 30 years.
Let's go out on this. You close your book by defending yourself against some of the attacks that you expect to hear from those on the right, particularly you push back against the idea that you are engaged in illiberalism in your argument. Give our listeners a little bit of that perspective, because I think it's something that some might raise as an objection to what you've been saying.
Well, you mentioned that I take issue with some statements that David French has made and others. And so I think the French Davidian criticism that I am going to receive as a result of this book is that I'm illiberal, I'm authoritarian, I'm a fascist, I'm whatever, you know, all the things that conservatives are constantly called. I think that if I am illiberal, I am still much more liberal than, say, John Locke, the father of liberalism. So I think I'm actually in a pretty safe situation here. So many people invoke John Locke. So many people invoke these thinkers of the past. You know, William F. Buckley Jr., for that matter, even as recent and as conservative a guy as him. But so few of them actually read these guys. You know, Bill Buckley, for instance, wrote his first book that launched the conservative movement, God and Man at Yale, as an attack on academic freedom. The subtitle of that book is The Superstitions of Academic Freedom. And he called academic freedom a hoax. It was a farce. Now, let's not forget his second book actually was defending Joe McCarthy. And though he tempered his support for sort of practical reasons later on, he was still defending McCarthy a dozen years later on his program in a television show called McCarthyism, Past, Present, and Future. I think people were a little worried that there might be a future to it. And I mentioned Buckley because Buckley, in his very, you know, Buckley-esque way, said that he did not want society to be more open. He said he wanted society to be a bit closed. He called himself an epistemological optimist. He said some things have been settled, we can know them, and he sees no reason to defend the liberty of a communist or a Nazi. And going back to the father of liberalism, I mean, in his letter concerning toleration, John Locke writes that people need to have free speech and they need to be tolerated, except for atheists. And his argument is not, it's not just some irrational bigotry. He's saying that an atheist is undermining in his views the whole system on which the toleration is based. And so you can't have that in what Chesterton might say is the thought that stops thought, which is a thought that, that ought to be stopped. John Milton, who is, wrote the most famous defense of free speech in the English language, Areopagitica, in that defense, he says everybody's got to have free speech. Except for Catholics. Now, I'm very glad that that standard has changed. You know, I, as a mackerel snapping papist myself, the book would not exist. My book would not exist if that were still in place. But his argument was coming out of this place that England had been roiled by religious conflict. And so a protection for that sort of limitless free speech would have disrupted the entire political order that the free speech regime rested on. I think at the most basic point, the most liberal people in history who have any coherence would admit that all speech regimes require some standards, some limits. If you're going to say that a man is a man, then you can't say that a man is a woman. You know, any speech regime requires us at least to be speaking the same language. The fact of speech is that the symbols that we use represent objective reality. And so if we can't even agree on the most basic aspects of that, we're not going to have a society. And so I think we need to get a whole lot more comfortable saying that there are limits here. We love the free marketplace of ideas, but someone sets the rules of the marketplace. And the left has understood this fact for a long time, which is how they've totally reshaped those rules. And I think that conservatives, if we want in any way to fight back against this thing, we need to stop falling for the trap, you know, the trap whereby we either go along with the new standard or abandon standards entirely. I think we just need to offer our own vision. That is what politics is. And, you know, an abstract defense of free speech just it means absolutely nothing to people who have nothing to say. So I think we need to answer the harder question of what is it that we want to say? It's not just the abstract right to freedom of belief, but what is it that we believe?
Michael Knowles, thank you so much for being so generous with your time.
Ben, thank you. It's great to be with you.
So I wanted to talk to you a little bit today about a new piece from Barry Weiss on her Substack, which is quickly becoming a must read. She writes about the approach that Amazon Studios is using when it comes to what they're calling a new inclusion policy. She writes, it announces a goal by 2024 of having 50% of creative roles in its movies and shows filled by women or people of color. In addition, the studio promises to try to cast actors whose identity, quote, gender identity, nationality, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, disability, unquote, matches that of the characters they play. One wonders how Ariel from The Little Mermaid or the sea monster from The Shape of Water would be slotted, and God save the intern who has to racially code Beauty and the Beast. By now, this is a familiar story. Amazon is turning the making of TV and film into the same woke numbers game played at every other elite institution. Exhibit A, 68% of the students admitted to Princeton's class of 2025 self-identify as people of color. I decided to read through Amazon Studios' inclusion playbook, she writes, designed to help disrupt the biases that occur across the life cycle of a series or movie, from the first inkling of a concept to viewers streaming the content on Prime Video. The playbook directed me to a fact sheet that promised to help improve my familiarity with all things diverse and inclusive. There, I encountered entries on things like acquired limb difference, otherwise known as amputation. There's an entry on mean girls, which I learned was a, quote, stereotype of girls and young women characterizing them as socially aggressive and unkind, characterizations that apparently not only enforce the bad behavior, but fail to address the larger social issues girls and women face, like insecurity, lack of confidence, and pressure to fit the feminine beauty ideal. Someone please relay that to Tina Fey. There were entries on Haka, I've been a fan for years, unnecessary intersex surgeries, bad, women, WIMXN, whatever happened to good old-fashioned women with a Y, and the biological clock, which
is explained as in relation to birthing people. The biological clock refers to the sense of pressure people feel to have children during their, quote, peak reproductive years. This, as a 37-year-old WIMXN birthing person, I can assure you that those scare quotes around the word peak, as though human reproduction is some kind of social construct, are superfluous. Moving right along, the inclusion playbook taught me that the Arabic word jihad means to strive and struggle for God, and is a term that describes personal betterment. Sharia, we are told, literally means the clear, well-trodden path to water. I also learned about the Yazidis, who are victims of the apparently nonviolent jihad waged by the Arab League, also covered in this document. Do I even need to tell you? There's no mention of Israel or of Jews. The playbook explains that the work of diversity, equity, and inclusion requires all of us to disrupt those biases and the longstanding customs and practices in the industry in order to achieve real lasting change. This work is not easy to do, but don't worry, we're in this together. Are we, though? Weiss writes. I wonder how the Amazon drivers afraid to take a bathroom break in order to keep up with their delivery quotas would feel about that. Or the workers in JFK 8, the company's Staten Island warehouse, who labor under the all-seeing eye of Jeff Bezos. More than 60% of the people who work in that warehouse, which is the size of 15 football fields, are Black or Hispanic. And according to a recent New York Times investigation, Black workers at JFK 8 were almost 50% more likely to be fired. I would really love for an Amazon executive to explain to me how understanding the difference between disabled and disabled, Amazon's inclusion playbook told me that disabled with a capital D refers to those who are culturally disabled, whatever that means, makes an actual difference in the lives of anyone at all. As Newsweek editor Batya Unger Sargon has noted, wokeness is, almost always, a smokescreen. By focusing the attention and energy of the rich and powerful on, say, whether the word Latinx is preferable to Hispanic, we let them off the hook for actually doing something about the fact that Latinos remain more than twice as likely to live below the poverty line as whites and Asians. To me, this is one of the most interesting phenomenons that we've been seeing in recent years and that we're going to continue to see. You are going to see American corporations wrap themselves in a smokescreen of wokeness in order to distract from the fact that they're actually not willing to make any changes that will truly benefit the communities. Instead, they're going to do things that appeal to white liberals, that the pity party sees as solving problems, but that actually don't address anything that is really going wrong. I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Ben Domenech Podcast. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.